This next story begins with an easily overlooked truth. America still makes stuff. For all the factories closed, all the wrenching changes in the global economy, the United States is a major manufacturer. And in the next few weeks, we'll report on how Americans are working to reinvent manufacturing.
Today, a new picture of manufacturing is coming into focus. Just so you know, that line, filled with puns.
Picture of manufacturing, focus.
Because we're going to visit a city that was all about images. Rochester, New York, made its name as home to Kodak, Xerox, and the eye care company Bausch & Lomb.
Manufacturing once employed 60% of Rochester's workforce. Now it's under 10%.
So Rochester is trying to build something new. And it's in Rochester that our colleague David Green begins a project we call American Made.
Historian Carolyn Vaca says if you want to understand the story of Rochester, you need to come here to High Falls, where on a bridge there's a waterfall and a panoramic view of downtown. This is a great spot. Where are we sitting?
We are in the heart of what was the center of Rochester historically and is still somewhat today, out over the Genesee River that attracted settlers because of the good dirt around it.
You said good dirt.
Yes, yeah. When revolutionary soldiers came through the area, they were coming from New England, where the dirt basically was good for holding rocks together at that point. And here, the soil is so fertile. So they immediately recognized the value of that and went home and told people, there's a place we can get land where you can be a successful farmer.
And farmers used that good Rochester dirt to grow grain. Of course, they needed somewhere to sell it, and that spawned flour mills. So many, in fact, that Rochester became known as Flour City. That legacy faded, though. The old mills along the river closed down, but the manufacturing seed had been planted, and something else grew out of it, a landmark high-rise that looms over the river.
That's Eastman Kodak, and for decades, Rochester was Kodak.
Kodak was built on Rochester's manufacturing legacy, and at its peak employed 60,000 people in this city. Today, it's just 2,300. It's been a painful collapse. And once again, in 2014, Rochester is trying to use its fertile soil to grow something new.
Nobody ever wants to let go, obviously, not of something like Kodak, that not only was so dominant, but had such a quality brand name. But recognizing that we have to, we've moved on and created new things, new prospects for the future, building on what we had in the past.
One thing Rochester got from Kodak was knowledge. There are former employees still at work in new places like this. We've moved 3 miles or so downriver to the factory floor at a company called Excellus. I'm standing with Mike Oganowski. He's the vice president of operations, and we're looking at this machine that has a giant spinning disc.
Mike, this looks like a large Lazy Susan that I would have on my dining room table to pass
kind
food
of, yeah.
around. What exactly is it doing?
This is actually polishing. It's a large polisher.
The kind of polisher once used for camera lenses at Kodak, where Oganowski worked for 27 years. Now that old expertise has found its way into new projects, huge ones. Excellus is making parts that may be in one of the largest telescopes on Earth, the 30-meter telescope. Once complete, it will peer out beyond the Milky Way to the edge of the observable universe, 13 billion light years away. Different scale, but same approach, and even some of the same tools.
But this room, I mean, I just look at it, and it makes me think that a lot of the stories I read about Kodak being gone.
Right.
Demise. I mean, it's the tradition is there in a very real way.
The tradition is there. It just has another name. Now we're called Excellus. Right? So the Kodak heritage technology that was there, that is essentially in the bedrock of what Kodak stood for back when George Eastman built it, is still there.
All that said, this picture is far from perfect. You look at this factory, making incredible things with machines, both old and new, but there's almost no one here. The factory is more than 16,000 square feet, only 80 people work here.
You look at the folks that are on this floor right now working, they're highly skilled. And what we want to do is make the work more of a science versus an art. Where optics in the past traditionally tends to be more art, and that's where the optician came in. So that means a lot of years of experience, a lot of manual labor, touching and feeling, and just gut feel.
Gut feel, touching things, making things with your hands. That was American manufacturing. Today, it's less art and more science, and this is exactly the challenge. Even when a place like Rochester seems to be figuring it out, this deeper problem remains. There are very few jobs for the blue-collar worker. It's a conundrum that this man thinks about a lot.
My name is Nabil Nasser. I'm the Associate Provost and Director of the Galsano Institute for Sustainability at Rochester Institute of Technology, RIT.
Part of Nasser's work at RIT is helping manufacturers cope with the changing landscape.
Manufacturing today is not what used to be. In the past, for example, Kodak used to make very sophisticated high-precision lenses in a very primitive process that was very time-consuming. Today, we're making very sophisticated computerized equipment that can make some of this lens in a fraction of the time they used to spend in making those lenses before. So I think things are changing, not just here in the U.S. I think everywhere else is changing, and a lot of people who relate to manufacturing still look at it from the same lens of the old ways of doing things.
And that all takes skill. And there are students right here at RIT training for the kinds of jobs they have at Excellus. But that still leaves the question.
Where's the blue-collar worker today? What options are there for them?
This is a serious issue. And I think there are a lot of people left out of the manufacturing sector. And there are a lot of barriers. First of all, in terms of some of the opening that we have in manufacturing, some of the really areas of needs, there are high-paying jobs, but we don't get qualified people because they require certain expertise and education in math and algebra and a lot of things that some people don't have the foundation for. They can't pass the exam, so as a result, companies cannot train, so they weren't thinking of that when they were in schools, and they're not able or willing to actually spend that time to get there.
And this is why we're spending a few weeks thinking about manufacturing in America. There is enormous potential. The U.S. leads the way in many types of research and technology. But as we've heard about for years now, new technology means fewer jobs. And when workers are needed, companies can find them cheaper abroad. So what does all of this mean for the United States? Where does the modern factory fit into American life? Professor Nasser, for his part, says policymakers, big companies, and communities have to come up with a plan.
Manufacturing is so critical. You know, I serve on an advisory board in Singapore. They want to take the best knowledge they can get to provide them with advice. Obviously, it's a small country, but it's just phenomenal to see the will and the desire to make things happen and the metrics they develop and the partnership between the government and industry. And, of course, they have a strong industrial policy.
Singapore is just one country in a global race, and we'll be hearing in the coming weeks how the U.S. is cultivating its manufacturing sector to make sure it stays competitive.
Our colleague David Green kicking off our American Made project with a visit to Rochester, New York. Tune in for more on the future of American manufacturing in the weeks to come.
Negotiators from Europe and the U.S. are meeting in Washington, trying again to reach a free trade agreement. The Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, would create the world's biggest free trade zone, but there is a problem here. Europeans are worried about American products, including American chicken. Susanna Capilouto reports.
Mutter Schimpf doesn't want to eat American chicken.
In Europe, there's definitely a disgust about chlorinated chicken.
Schimpf is with the group Friends of the Earth Europe. Chlorinated chicken is what she calls U.S. poultry, and she doesn't want it in Europe, where chlorine was banned in the 90s, out of fear that it could cause cancer. U.S. poultry is chilled in antimicrobial baths that can include chlorine to keep salmonella and other bacteria in check. Europeans now worry the TTIP treaty could bring them U.S. chicken. On the German equivalent of the Daily Show, it is called the Heute Show, U.S. poultry has become a running joke. In this skit, a reporter is in the White House kitchen eating a chicken nugget. He jokes, you can't be mad at someone who makes such a tasty chlorinated chicken. It has a slight aroma of kiddie pool, he quips.
Most of those concerns about, you know, chemical use and those kinds of things are blown up in the media to become a problem that really doesn't exist.
Scott Russell teaches poultry science at the University of Georgia. He says U.S. processors use about a capful of chlorine per gallon or 50 parts per million in a water tank that chills the chicken carcass. And that chlorine, he says, keeps chicken safe, gets washed off, and is no harm to consumers. Europeans, he says, use a different approach.
In Europe, their efforts at controlling foodborne illnesses is all in the live bird. For example, the grandparent stock, the breeder stock, all of those flocks of chickens are tested regularly for salmonella. If they're positive, they remove them, all of them.
And with this method, Europeans have reduced salmonella in their chicken to just 2%, says Russell, but it took nearly 20 years to get there. Europeans have pushed for some of the toughest food safety standards in the world. They want to eat fresh chicken that's air-chilled rather than dumped in chlorine water tanks, says Kes Vermeeren with the Association of the European Poultry Industry. We spoke via Skype.
The main principle of the food policy in the European Union is the so-called farm-to-fork approach. And you may say that's a bit fundamentally different in what's happening outside Europe in many places.
That strict food policy makes poultry production more expensive. A study by Wageningen University in the Netherlands shows it takes about $1 in Europe to produce a pound of chicken. The U.S. can do it for less than 80 cents. James Sumner is president of the U.S. Poultry Export Council. He says over 120 countries accept the U.S. processing method. It's cheaper, and Europe, he says, doesn't want U.S. competition.
If the truth were to be known, that's the real reason they don't want us there, and chlorine is a convenient excuse.
For activists like Mutter Schimpf, who are trying to sway the public to reject a big treaty that's full of legal jargon and complicated regulations, the chicken argument works.
So to simplify it, in Europe, very often the chlorinated chicken is used as a symbol to describe what European consumers and citizens don't want to have as an outcome from the trade talks.
Besides changes in chicken production, activists are also fighting the possibility of hormone-treated beef and genetically engineered crops on the European market should TTIP succeed. The talks between the U.S. and the EU are held in secret, but any agreement needs the nod of the European Parliament, which is elected by a public that worries a lot about its food supply. For NPR News, I'm Susanna Capoluto in Atlanta.
Argentina is still mired in a court battle with a group of U.S. bondholders tied up in its debt. A federal judge in New York has declared the government of Argentina in contempt of court for defying orders. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports that the judge will decide later whether to impose financial sanctions on the country.
Judge Thomas Grisey has often expressed frustration with Argentina and its unwillingness to pay off a small group of hedge funds who have refused to accept anything but full payment for bonds they hold. Yesterday, he went further than ever, taking the very rare step of declaring the government in civil contempt. He said the country has been defying his rulings by attempting to replace the U.S. bank that serves as trustee in the case with an Argentine bank, which would give the government more influence over the case. The Argentine legislature has also recently passed a law that would attempt to move the debt proceedings to Buenos Aires. But Grisey said the bonds were sold in the United States with the expectation that any disputes would be heard in New York. In fact, he said that was one of their selling points. Grisey said he would decide later how much of a fine to impose on Argentina. Lawyers for the hedge funds have urged the judge to fine the government as much as $50,000 a day. Meanwhile, attorneys for Argentina said the contempt ruling was not only legally inappropriate, but would make matters worse. The government sent a letter to Secretary of State John Kerry warning that the ruling would result in an unprecedented escalation in the conflict. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.